Why don't we go ahead and get started? I think we try to start at quarter of on the nose. My name is Hannah Riley Bowles. I'm the research director here at the Women in Public Policy Center, where we are dedicated to closing gender gaps in the areas of economic opportunity, political participation, health, and education. And this is our first Thursday lunchtime seminar. We have a whole seminar series set up, I think probably as all of you know if you're here, throughout the semester. We're very excited about it. If you were at the WAP welcome, you would have heard me explain, but just in case you weren't, that last year we had a really rich series of discussions around intersections of race and gender. We had our whole seminar series, but then we had that theme kind of running through it. We found that very fruitful. So this semester we're going to have a really broad array of studies, but we have two themes, one of which is around kind of work and family, and the other one is around women's political participation. And so what's wonderful today, this will be our first talk in our sort of sub-theme around work and family intersections, or policy and family intersections. Let me introduce our speakers today. We are thrilled to have Karen Eggleston, who is the Director of Asia Health Policy Program at Stanford University. Perhaps most importantly, she is one of our esteemed alumna from our doctoral programs, and is a thrill to have her back. She is presenting joint work with Richard Zeckhauser, who really requires no introduction around here. But he is the esteemed senior professor here at the school. Richard's research is very broad in scope, but one piece of it relates to promoting the health of human beings and the function of markets in that process. So we are thrilled to have Karen here, and she's going to present with us a piece of her work looking at government and the market's roles in the health sector. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. Thank you all for coming. Good morning. It's a real privilege and honor to be here. On a personal note, it's wonderful to be back. I have fond memories of graduate seminars in this very building. And it's exciting to speak with you about some of our current research. So as mentioned, this is joint research with Kennedy School's very own Richard Zeckhauser and with two other co-authors, Haifeng, who's now at Peking University, and John Rizzo at SUNY Stony Brook. So we'll be talking about jobs and kids, about female employment and fertility in China. So this, there are many reasons why it could be considered an important topic, perhaps primarily because of the scope of China's population. As you all know, a fifth of humanity is an important part to be talking about, most populous country in the world. And controlling population growth has been a policy priority for over 30 years in that country, dating to the 1970s. At the same time, China, of course, as many of you know, has undergone a significant transition from a centrally planned economy to a market-based economy, attaining the fastest economic growth in the world sustained over several decades. And ample effective labor supply is an important ingredient to that growth performance. The growth is now slowing alongside some demographic change for a whole series of reasons. Now, we're going to be talking specifically about employment and fertility, and the goal is to determine how female employment affects and is affected by fertility. So determining causality, as that sentence implies, is an important concern, because causality flows in both directions, from employment to fertility choices and fertility choices to employment choices. So a prime goal of this exercise is to estimate the effect of employment on fertility, accounting for the other direction of causality. So, and arguably, this is a doubly important topic given China's one-child policy. So may I ask how many of you study China, are from China, have been to China? Many? So you may be very familiar with this, but I just wanted to state for those who might be less familiar the reason why I have one child policy in quotation marks. So there are a whole series of family planning policies in China. And although most urban couples are restricted to a single child per household, in rural areas it's more like a one son, two child policy, and so on. We can talk more about that as we go along. So that policy, which is now being relaxed somewhat, is highly contentious both within the country and internationally. And so an ancillary question that we want to talk about in background to this research is, might there be less draconian methods of controlling population in China and elsewhere? So So obviously our concern in this research is China, as the title implies, but this is a topic, this is more broadly relevant, thinking about female employment, fertility, as you were saying, is one of the themes related to work and family. It's important across a broad array of nations, of course, including here in the United States. So what I'll be doing today, and I want to emphasize that we welcome questions at any point along the way, so feel free to jump in, and we'll retain some time at the end also for discussion. I'll be talking some background about fertility and employment in China specifically, and then an international comparative perspective, something about relationship between fertility and female labor force participation. I'll be using that FLFP acronym you'll see in the slides. It's basically employment plus people who are actively seeking work. And then I'll talk about our study specifically, the data we use from 2006, a survey, the methods, the results we find, and some discussion about the policy implications. So as many of you may be very well aware, China's undergone dramatic change. Looking at the early Mao era, 1949, early 1950s, China population about a half a billion, 36% children, 80% rural, one-third illiterate, and living, certainly by today's standards and even comparatively back then, in relative absolute poverty. Contrast that with what the latest census has found in 2010. In China, a population of 1.34 billion and growing, a population that is rapidly aging, half urban, 96% literate, and with a significant fraction, 23%, high school or college education. A middle-income country with three decades, as we noted, of unprecedented economic growth. So this graph gives you some indication about fertility trends in China. China's in red here, and we have births per woman on the vertical axis and years since the 1960s. The horizontal axis. And what you can see here is that there is a dramatic decline in births per woman since that earlier period, and particularly in the single decade of the 1970s. Does anybody know when the one-child policy was implemented? 1980, roughly. Yeah, so the dramatic decline in fertility preceded that policy. Just to note, there were some earlier family planning policies later marriage, more space between births, fewer children, that helped to bring about that fertility transition. And there's some dispute about the exact numbers. We can talk about that if you want. But there's consensus among demographers in China and outside China that fertility rate has been below replacement level, around 2, for a couple of decades, and is now 1.5, 1.6, somewhere in that range, much lower than India, which is shown there. And at the same time, Chinese have generally been living longer and healthier lives. So this shows life expectancy on the vertical axis in China, again in red. And you can see a dramatic improvement in life expectancy since the early Mao era, recovering from the Great Lake Famine of 1960, and continued improvement to today, putting China on par even with some higher income countries now. And this combination of lower fertility and longer lives has led to a large population, which is now rapidly aging. So here we have population numbers by age group in the population and across different years projected out to 2050. You can see there's a large chunk of the population in the working ages, 20 to 50 or so, and that's working its way through into the older ages as we go. We'll be looking at this yellow slice here about the mid-2000s with our data.
I mean, I just have to comment, it's a beautiful station of that data.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
We also have more substantive things to say as we move along. I just have to comment on that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it shows it also really well, yeah.
Yes, and of course, looking into the future depends on some assumptions about future fertility, but basic patterns is clear. And this is one reason why this kind of research is very relevant to you, the top levels of policymaking in China as well, which we'll come back to. And important, of course, for background, and any of you from China or studied China are well aware of this, China is a very large and diverse country. And even though I'll be talking most of the time about China, keep in the back of your mind that it's very diverse. And just to give a few examples of that, looking at what we were just discussing, life expectancy, if you look at Chinese in the richest province, Shanghai, and in the poorest provinces, Yunnan, Guizhou, Tibet, there's a difference of average life expectancy of a full 10 years. So that's bigger than the life expectancy gap between China as a whole and the US. So within China, you have tremendous differences. To give yet another example of this diversity, there's a lot of diversity in fertility rates as well. You might think, well, how can you be studying fertility in China? Doesn't everybody have to one child? Well, as I mentioned, there is some variation in that for many reasons. What do you think is the total fertility rate of Beijing? Does anybody happen to know or want to venture a guess?
Below one.
Yeah. 1.5? That would be around the national average. Anyone else? It's about 0.7, which is very low, as many of you guess. Just for comparison, the US, we're around replacement level 2.1. Japan, which has a significant low fertility and declining population issue, is around 1.4, twice. Hong Kong, which has never had a one-child policy, but has one of the lowest fertility rates in the world, 1.1, and Singapore, 1.8. So getting back to our specific topic for this research related to jobs and kids, there has been found a relationship between female labor force participation and fertility that is negative. A negative correlation has been found across many countries and time periods. Although one might note, particularly in other high-income countries, OECD countries, there's been a recent moderation, so less of a negative correlation there, associated with reducing the incompatibilities of employment with motherhood. Some cases from Sweden, for example, and others that we could discuss. Interesting to note, of course, China's a different place, a different stage of socioeconomic development, and also undergoing this very specific economic and social transition. So there has been a reduction in fertility that I just showed you, and concurrent with that, at the macro level, there's actually been a significant reduction in female labor force participation. So the two have been going down. So are they positively correlated?
This is interesting. Like last year, we had a couple of presentations on fertility and women's economic participation, and Mary Brinson from the sociology department here was actually making the argument that women's economic participation was actually, in certain OECD countries, potentially positively correlated with fertility because they could afford to have children.
Yeah, there's been some controversy about this, and we can certainly discuss it more, but certainly there's definitely been a moderation. So in some places that you could contrast, say, Sweden with Japan, for example, where there are many more women working in Sweden in higher fertility than in Japan, many fewer women working in much lower. So we wanted to look at that question in China, which many things are changing, very rapid urbanization and so on. So to give some more background on specifically what's happening in China, there was very high female labor force participation during the Mao era. Mao, of course, had the famous slogan, "Women hold up half the sky." And as part of the socialist economic strategy, everyone, able-bodied adult, was expected to work full-time. Of course, China was primarily agricultural, so they were working for work points on the commune and also in the newly industrializing factories. And women were fully expected to do that, and each work done way would have, you know, a child care center on site to make that possible. Now, during the reform era, and of course, they would also be things like the barefoot doctor. Here's our illustration of a woman in that role. Now, during the economic restructuring since the late 1970s and 1980s, there's been large changes in the labor market in China. And there are some prominent gender differences that have been exhibited in that labor market restructuring. So to just mention a few, the layoffs from state-owned enterprises that really got underway in the 1990s disproportionately affected women, particularly urban and older women. And the female labor force participation in China declined from what was, of course, very high levels in the Mao era, but still very high by international standards as China became factory to the world, as it's known. So to give you some example of that, many of you are from China or know China. Perhaps you've been to Beijing and Shanghai, perhaps not as much out into the rural areas. And we wanted to show here about how combination of child rearing and work took place in the rural areas. This is the Los Plateau out in the northwest or in the southwest, and women would work very hard at the home on the farm and could carry an infant in this basket or have their children play around with them and combine these two roles as in traditional China to some extent. With the rapid change in China's economy, as in many places in the world, for working women, the combination of off-farm employment, there are difficulties, various sets of institutional and other conditions that make it difficult to combine that kind of work with child caregiving in the same way. So many able-bodied people, particularly of prime working ages, both men and women, will work off the farm increasingly in China, both in rural areas, but also entailing migration. So often it entails temporary migration from village to town, town to city, across provinces. Indeed, in the 2010 census, a total of 220 million people in China were engaged in temporary migration across the country. And you can see why there are, this is a dormitory where the workers in a factory all live in the dormitory. This is the cafeteria there. It's not easy to combine that with family life for various other reasons we can also discuss. And children sometimes are left behind, either with the grandparents or sometimes on their own, which is a small fraction of children, but in China that's still a large number. Yes?
The dormitories are typically gender segregated?
Yes. So, and these women are engaged in a wide range of factory work. Here are some from manufacturing the toys that you might see, you know, in your local Walmart. So, and another very important question that we're not even going to begin to try to answer in this research, but it's important in as background, is to think, has the value placed on women in China somehow changed over time? It's not clear how to measure this, but some suggested evidence gives some mixed messages. So I'm just going to give two examples. One, on the positive side, educational attainment of women in China has risen dramatically for the time period where we have good data since the 1950s. I'll show you that in a minute. And among the youngest age cohorts, the young people now, particularly in urban China, girls and boys are pretty much on par. But some preference is also evident, and creating a large gender imbalance in China's population that's going to lead to large stresses in the marriage market already is. So to talk about schooling, here it shows average years of schooling for females 25 to 29 who have completed their education. And you can see China here in this dramatic increase from less than half a year of formal schooling on average for young women in China in 1950. To over 10 now, which approximates many higher income countries, dramatically more than, say, in India. Of course, there are remaining differences, particularly rural China, less education for boys and girls, still clear behind. On the other hand, gender imbalance, just to give one illustration of that, this graph shows the sex ratio at birth, males per 100 females born for each province, from 1982, 1990, 2000, and 2005 from the different censuses. And what do these colors mean? Well, green is normal, about as many boy infants as girl infants. Blue, which you can already see spreading at the beginning, 1982, is more boys than girls, 107 to 112. And the red is most severe. That's 120 to over 130 boy infants to every 100 girl infants. And by 2010 in the census, the average for all of China, including, you know, the only normal one, Tibet, and averaged across these ones that have very skewed ratios, the average is 110 boy infants. I mean, 118 boy infants for every 100 girls born. So a significant gender imbalance in the population there, which has many implications moving forward. Yes?
This is a hypothetical question, but of course the economists in us would think, oh, maybe that's going to change the value of women again because now women are in demand. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing anything of that sort?
Very interesting question. And the change in the bride price and the dowry and all those things. And people look at the experience, say, of South Korea, which had very, very skewed and then is now much more normal. It's not yet clear. I mean, people had expected, given many of the policies adopted, that there would be much more moderation of the sex ratio imbalance, and it came as a surprise to many that it was still so high, not to researchers in this field who knew it. So it may change in the future, and one could hope that socioeconomic development would, but it's not entirely clear yet what's going to happen. And there are many policies that try to address this, and you know, we can discuss that much more. But the people that end up suffering most, you could say, arguably, are the poor rural men who will never be able to marry.
I have a second question, if I may. Again, I don't know what it's central for, where you want to go, and I also don't know what you have an answer, but the son preference seems to have increased in the last 20 to 30 years.
I was going to mention that. Yeah, the revealed son preference, and again, we debate this, but it doesn't seem that really the son preference itself has changed. Mm. It's the constraints and the ability to realize that son preference. So what technology has enabled this?
Sex-selective
abortion, which is technically illegal, but is widely available and became much more widely available at relatively low cost.
I asked a question because Rob Jensen has this, I think, fabulous paper where he shows that, right, you can influence preferences, parental preferences for boys or girls by the economic returns that
yes.
daughters and sons can have in the future. And now with women working less, that, I'm just saying, could have contributed, including with technological change, could also contribute to an increased son preference. You know,
it could, and there's a lot of research suggesting that even something you might think is so different as China's huge savings rate is related to this, because they have to save a lot to enable their sons to purchase a wife by having a home and so on. So there are many, many widespread implications of this. But we don't know exactly where it's going to go. Rob Jensen, by the way, we've co-authored with him. Great research.
Yeah. The other notion is that there are significant lags in all this. So now there's this real problem, which we met when we were in China, of men not being able to get married. I mean, even in not so rural areas. And but you don't know that, you know, 25 years ago, you didn't know that that was going to happen. I mean, maybe Eric Spinette would have said, oh, I'm an economist, I can reject that. But at the time, hey, we all want to have boys. And nobody was sort of looking ahead. I mean, it's not so different than what goes on in the United States with regard to various professions.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes 20 years before the educational system sort of recognizes that, you know, nobody's hiring, you know, English PhDs.
And social policy, just a second, social policy does have a lag, too, and a role to play. I mean, obviously, it's to carry on the family name and other reasons for son preference, but it's also because in rural China, the elderly depend on having sons. And without sons to support you, you're destitute. They've never had pensions. So now China just in 2009 introduced a rural pension program and other policies are put in place. And there has been research showing that when returns to having a girl the same as to boys, there is more moderation of that. So we'll see how it plays out.
To what extent have they revised immigration rules or laws regarding women?
Not much. There has been some across the border with the South from Southeast Asia. It's fairly controversial. There also have been women, say, Korean Chinese women going to Korea to marry the men there because they have gender imbalance there. So there's flow both ways. And the largest flow, of course, is from some of these Western poorer provinces to other provinces within China. It's a fairly large flow of brides as well as others. There are many different policies. I mentioned the Social Security. Sometimes the land division within is according to the number of sons. And so there are many factors that play into this, and not just pure preference, but other factors that households are dealing with. And that'll be an important point because we'll show in the analysis that whether your first child is a boy or a girl affects the choices that we're studying. Thank you. So women's education and employment, returns to education in China have increased substantially. So during the Mao era, there was not so much of a return to education, more to experience, but very equal wages. And this changed a lot with market-based labor markets. Simultaneously, the gender earnings differential has increased, even for similarly educated men and women in China. And unemployment among women is higher than among men, particularly the younger and the older ages. But even among prime age, that is, according to this author, age 30 to 40, among prime age working people, unemployment is higher for women than for men. And many women, of course, are in specific occupations, working, creating toys, textiles in the service sector, and so on. So our study, a preview of what we're going to look at here. We study how female employment affects fertility, that specific causal pathway we're trying to isolate. We first develop a conceptual model that shows how employment prospects affect fertility choices. And then we use data on over 2,000 married women from the 2006 China Health and Nutrition Survey to look at this question. Empirical methods are important for this. I won't dwell on them in the research, but jump in if you have any questions. As already noted, assessing causality is a key concern. So the use of an instrumental variable, at least if you have a good instrumental variable, can address this problem. So a good instrumental variable predicts the independent variable, but not the dependent variable. So to give one example of that, say you're studying the impact of community college education on wages. And the instrument is the distance to a community college. The argument there is that those who live closer go to community colleges more. However, the distance does not directly affect wages. So it can predict whether you go and then help you identify whether going to community college education affects wages. So we're going to try and have an instrument for female employment. And controlling for endogeneity with this instrumental variables approach, which is essentially controlling for reverse causality as best we can, yields a larger negative effect of female employment on fertility choices. And in our preferred specification, we find that female employment reduces the desired number of children by 0.35 children on average, and reduces the actual number of children by about 0.5. We also find that having a first child who is a son is associated with lower fertility, both preferred and actual, going back to the point just raised.
Are you going to,
yes.
Probably later, I'm jumping ahead, so just stop me, but is this a dummy variable, employment, yes, no? Or
employment
does it depend on what kind of employment?
We also have occupations, but the employment itself is yes, no. I'll show you the definition in a moment. Yeah. So to look at those causal pathways, as we just said, employment may reduce fertility, but of course, fertility choices may also impact employment choices, so both ways. And there are other variables that you want to think of. Fertility, in some sense, larger families may need more money, and higher income may lead to more fertility, at least over low to medium incomes. It's worth noting that almost all research in China has found this, but most of the rest of the world, the correlation goes the other way, that wealthier people have fewer children. But it's important, therefore, to look at when women work, there is the fact of employment, but there's also the extra income from working, and the two can be conflated. One is boosting fertility, one is decreasing it, perhaps. So first, to think about this with some clarity, we developed a conceptual model. The woman, the household decision maker in this simple model, values consumption, C, leisure, here, and children. And utility from children is less than linear. And women differ along two dimensions, their preference for children and their opportunities for off-farm employment. And into the model, we build a question of enlarging work opportunities. This is related to our empirical work. We assume that access to a bus stop saves travel time to employment and thus reduces the time commitment of an off-farm job. So having a bus stop right in your village or your urban community will allow you to access more off-farm employment. And we won't go into detail about the model, but I just want to show you this figure. This shows that women with better employment opportunities choose employment more often, and then, depending on trade-offs, prefer to have fewer children. So what do we have here? We have on the horizontal axis women's taste for children. So is you have a greater taste for children, you move from having one to two to more children. And here on the vertical axis, we have the extra salary from having off-farm employment. At a low salary, no one chooses to work off the farm, but for a high enough salary, there's some cutoff point where women will choose off-farm employment. And for those who prefer children more because of the time commitment and the incompatibility, or the difficulty of combining the two, the people that have higher preferences will require a higher threshold wage before they choose off-farm employment. And what is this shaded area here? That's the effect of a bus stop. So going from having no bus stop to having a bus stop shifts down this threshold because less of a time commitment, so people will accept off-farm employment more. And you'll find some women, particularly in this area here, who would have had to choose to have one and work off the farm. Now, it's worth noting that there are others who switch in the other direction, so ultimately it's an empirical question how these two variables are related, and that's what we study with the data.
So you're assuming that bus stops are like an exogenous shock.
Yes.
How should I think about people moving closer to bus stops?
Right, well, there are many things that you could think about there, and we talk about some in the paper about policies in China about how they constructed bus stops. But the thing to note is that mobility of your permanent home in China is relatively, I mean, the main mobility is temporary migration, which is enabled by bus stops. But moving toward an area that, I mean, you don't tend to have that. Obviously, there is some of it. But, we are definitely assuming that it's basically exogenous, and that's what enables use of the instrumental variable. But we can certainly come back to discuss that. So there are many previous studies on China. I think in the interest of time, I won't go through one by one. Most of them are estimated with earlier data from the 1980s. Here are some that include men and women. Wives' occupation is sometimes not statistically significant. Being a cadre, of course, increases compliance with the one-child policy. Women who never work, less likely to have only one child, and so on. And then other studies from the 1990s. Here, as we were just mentioning, the role of income. So they find that female earned income significantly boosts fertility. So you might find if you're not separately controlling for that, that there's a positive correlation there. And a more recent unpublished study about having two or more kids reducing female labor force participation in rural China, but using the 1990 census. So we're going to use much more recent data, look at both urban and rural China, and try to make a case for looking at a specific direction of causality from employment to fertility. So the data we use, I don't know if any of you are already familiar with, it's publicly available, so widely used in this area, the China Health and Nutrition Survey data wave from the year 2006. Includes over 11,000 adult and child respondents. They come from 9 provinces in China, so it's not a nationally representative sample. Let's just be clear about that. But it does represent a wide variety of geographies and levels of socioeconomic development in China. And there's a detailed community survey supplement that gives us community level variables. Our sample includes all women who were ever married below age 52, and that gives us 2,355 respondents. So these are the provinces included in the survey, circled in red, from Heilongjiang up in the north, mostly coastal, but also more inland and in the south, and a range. So the Guizhou has a lot of minority population, Shandong more like the average, Jiangsu quite wealthy, just north of Shanghai, and so on. Yes?
Where does this data come specifically for married women's fertility rates? Can you share the data on unmarried women's births in China?
That could be looked at separately in this data, but they're very strict family planning policies in China, and it's much lower than in many other places. Most of births are too many women.
Sure. Thanks.
Or, yeah. Mm-hmm. And this data is publicly available, so people can look.
I'm just a little bit skeptical about the provinces they've selected, because it doesn't include Beijing, Shanghai, like, you know, the rich coastal areas, include a lot of, like, highly educated professionals, women professionals, but also didn't include women from Sichuan, for example. It's one of the, Chongqing, the most populous cities and provinces in China, who produces a lot of workers for manufacturing sector. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's not nationally representative. It does include a wide variety of towns. So Jiangsu, for example, includes Suzhou, which is, you know, very highly economically developed region, and many cities that would have very low fertility rates, and then many rural areas of these same provinces. So it's just looking at this particular area of China with that micro data, and it can be looked at with, we'd love to have the 2010 census data if that micro data is ever made available to researchers outside. And there are many other studies that have used different data sets. We can talk about similarities or differences. But it is certainly something to keep in mind. And we would love to, you know, show how robust this is, including Chongqing or some of those other areas. Yes?
Actually, a follow-up to that. Is there a big difference in the urban-rural in terms of both employment and fertility? And were you able to design?
Oh, very much, yeah. So we control separately for those and indeed ran separate progressions originally. So, and that does make a big difference. But once you control for family planning policies, which are highly correlated with urban or rural, or more specifically the hukou or the registration status, then that sometimes wipes out urban-rural dummy in the regressions because it's very highly correlated. You know, have the ability to have a second child in rural areas. So the fertility variables, we have two. One is the actual number of children, so that measures cumulative fertility, and preferred number of children, and this is in response to a question asked in the survey, so we can debate whether people would honestly and straightforwardly answer this question given policies, but we thought it was worth looking at. So the question that they asked, if you could choose the number of children to have, how many more children would you want? So obviously there's an assumption embedded in that question, and we coded the preferred number of children as the actual number plus any additional children. So you might think maybe you're asking a very young woman and she hasn't yet had her children, so maybe she's planning to have more. Or maybe you're asking an older woman who's in her 50s and already completed her childbearing, but in a different world she might have wanted to have a different number of children. So preferred fertility obviously will equal actual fertility if the preferences are realized. An off-farm employment variable, to be specific about that, is in response to two household survey questions. Are you presently working? Yes, no. And what is your primary occupation? And off-farm employment equals one if the respondent is working, so yes. And the primary occupation is farmer. The other ones are very small. So it's a binary variable.
Is not farmer.
Otherwise,
is farmer.
So is not farmer, yes. Sorry, so off-farm employment. So, yes, they are working, and they are not a farmer, a fisherman, or a hunter.
Karen, do you also have male fertility preferences, or just the women's?
Just the women's.
What an unbiased survey.
Yes.
Oh, they don't ask the men. But do you have the number of men? I mean, have you looked at the number of...
Well, you could...
I mean, you look at 40 to 50-year-olds or something like that, and look at how many... children they, I mean, people look at people of an age where they're unlikely to have more children, and then look at, I mean, does the data look different for men than women? Because you could imagine it looking quite similar. I mean, there's a story one you could tell.
Well, there are striking, see, age and birth cohorts are strikingly important in China. So the older people in our sample are not only older, but they were the birth cohorts that didn't have family planning policies, you know, when they were in their childbearing years.
Even 40-year-olds?
So if we go up to age 52, so those in the 40 to 50 range could have three or four children. And the younger, so there's, I'm just saying that one has to differentiate that birth cohort effect.
But if you just compared men and women within that
you could, it would be very interesting
cohort
to look at.
And just see whether there's a sort of general thing, a cultural thing as opposed to a gender
I might
thing.
Just preview that we do much better at looking at predicting actual fertility than fertility preferences. So that's
so
the
that
whole
would
area
even
thing.
For that, doing that all the more.
You could do a whole separate
yeah.
study on trying to understand that particular variable, definitely. So our instrumental variable, as already alluded to, is a bus stop in your village or your community.
so important to remember that most people in rural China, and many indeed in urban China, regularly use public transportation. And so arguably bus stops enable people to work in other villages or town, off farm, temporary migration, and so on. So this is reported in the community survey. So I won't dwell on our empirical strategy. It's sort of a plain vanilla for those who do these kind of statistical analyses. Fertility, we have a range of other measures, a binary indicator of employment, and then we use ordinary least squares estimation, and because it's count variable, another variation used Poisson estimation. And to account for this reverse causality, we use two-stage least squares with our instrumental variable as the bus stop in that first stage equation. This is a standard technique for addressing the issue of reverse causality. It's only as good as your instruments, so we can certainly discuss that. And I'll talk about the results from all of the different estimations. Our preferred one, two-stage residual inclusion, Poisson, probit in the first stage, Poisson in the second stage, and bootstrapping of the standard errors and so on. If anyone's interested, we can discuss. It's in the paper. So what do we find? Descriptive statistics, in our sample, 64% are not working off the farm, and 36% are working off the farm. And there is a significant difference in mean fertility rates. So here we have the actual number of children is at the mean 1.65 for those who are not employed and 1.2 for those who are employed. Preferred fertility is higher in both cases, so some fraction of the women are saying they would prefer to have more children. So preferred number of children 1.77 for those not employed and 1.38 for those who are employed. We also show the instrumental variable to make the case for its plausibility. So among the women who are not working off the farm, 60% have access to a bus stop in their village or community. And those employed, it goes up to 75%. So the first stage, again, we won't dwell on the test for instruments, but just to show there is a positive correlation of having the bus stop and employment, some suggestion that it might be a plausible instrument. Ordinary least squares and two-stage least squares estimation, we do find a negative correlation between female employment and both preferred number of children and actual number of children. Now this estimation, ordinary least squares, has both directions of causality in it. This second two-stage tries to isolate effective employment on fertility. actual number of children is still negative and larger in absolute magnitude. And in our preferred estimation, Poisson, I'll just skip this top panel. If you look at the Poisson estimation with two-stage residual inclusion, the effect of a woman working off the farm, we estimate is a reduction of 0.35 in preferred number of children and about 0.5 in the actual number of children.
Can you just say why we use Poisson?
Well, first of all, it's a binary variable, and it fits the data better.
Sure what it means to have a bus stop. I mean, in a small little Chinese village, a bus stop made sense to me in the context of an urban city.
Mm-hmm.
You would expect there to be a lot of bus stops, and some of the areas where your survey covers includes.
Yes, that's true, and there would be also obviously subways and other public transportation that people in urban areas take. But it doesn't have to perfectly predict. It just has to be highly correlated and not correlated with fertility. So we can discuss that, but it does prove to both for the urban and the rural sample be highly positive correlated with women-female labor force participation, even controlling for a dummy for urban-rural, for their education, for province-specific dummies, and so on in the first stage regression. We tried other instruments. We can also discuss those if you're interested. But to allow more time for discussion, I think I'll finish up here. Yeah.
Don't you have to control for one-child policy? Some areas.
Yes, we do control for the one-child policy. I just didn't have time and space to show all the variables. But we do have a variable for the policies that were mentioned.
the specific areas where you're allowed to have a second child if the first is a girl, whether you get a subsidized if you only have girls. And indeed, those are the variables that I mentioned earlier that in some specifications, they're always significant, and in some specifications, they wipe out the statistical significance of urban-rural because they're more important. So just to emphasize our main results, what are we finding? Regardless of the statistical method, we're finding a negative correlation. As I mentioned earlier, you find in many countries and points in time, a negative correlation between fertility and female labor force participation in contemporary China. And after controlling for endogeneity with this two-stage procedure that I briefly described, the negative effects of female employment on preferred number of children and actual number of children is actually larger in absolute magnitude. Also, to look at some of the other covariates that we included in our regressions, household annual income positively affects fertility in China, at least according to these estimates. Education, this is of the woman, negatively affects fertility and strongly. And having a first child who is a son significantly reduces both preferred and actual fertility. And I might just mention that the province-specific effects are also highly significant. So China is very large and diverse. And the one-child policy variables are significant as well and reduce fertility, unsurprisingly. Yes?
So the education negatively affecting fertility, is that after controlling for the household income?
Yes.
Okay.
So we're attempting to disentangle those two channels. So more income means that you might prefer to have more children in the Chinese context. When we're controlling for that, the employment effect directly on fertility is negative. So some discussion. We just wanted to emphasize that employment policies have significant implications for fertility in China, indeed around the world. These are often thought as separate areas of public policy, but most employment policies will have some implications for fertility as well. Might enhancing employment opportunities for women in China help to control fertility? If you're worried about fertility being very high once the policies are relaxed, we'll say yes. How should we feel about the secondary effects of such a policy? Well, we'll throw it up for discussion. We first wanted to mention that there's potential for a win-win-win situation here, we believe. So encouraging greater rates of off-farm employment for women could substantially reduce fertility compared to counterfactual without requiring any of the punishments and penalties for which China has been criticized and engenders a lot of resentment among many people within China as well. And further improvements in education can play an important role here as well, because as we saw in the estimation, increases in education would complement these policies because independent of working or not, more educated women tend to have lower fertility choices, and more educated women are more productive in the workforce. So potential for a win-win, greater opportunities for women. While fertility is unlikely to rebound than higher than replacement levels, which is one of the concerns of policymakers, and less resentment of state policies, perhaps. And just to note, step back for a minute at the macro level where we started about China's economic growth. This can play into that as well. Now, China's losing its so-called demographic dividend, where it had those large cohorts concentrated in the working ages that I showed in that graph earlier. And it's been shown that that demographic dividend contributed, the dividend itself is how it contributes to economic growth. And research has shown that from 15% to even a quarter of high growth rates in East Asia, and in China in particular, this 15% of per capita economic growth rates can be accounted for by pure demographics about having a large number of people in the working ages. And now those people are aging in China. The factors that will slow future economic growth are many and not just demographic, but it will be slowed by higher old age dependency ratios, relative shortage of skilled labor, some debate about to what extent that's already being revealed in China, burden of chronic disease and other factors. Just to note, relating to our research here, increasing educational attainment will boost productivity, and maintaining or increasing female labor force participation in particular can offset the reduction in the working age population in China to some extent.
So at the macro level, that would also be important to consider. Of course, like any study, there are limitations and extensions you might want to do to this research. We've already discussed some of them. We are continuing to work in this area. More data, more recent, more representative, and so on, as was mentioned. But in conclusion, all employment policies have fertility implications, and we found that female off-farm employment significantly reduces fertility in China. So, xiexie. Thank you very much.
I found your presentation very interesting, and while not sort of familiar with this area, it made me think of a couple of things. The first is some work that I'm aware of that's been done on employment and fertility in France, I think it is, where one of the big issues was childcare access and the sort of emphasis on the government put on increasing fertility by increasing access to childcare. So I was interested in the fact that you didn't actually talk much about childcare and access to childcare and the implications it might have had, because one could imagine that if you had you know, access to childcare, you wouldn't need as much money to have children, depending upon the cost of the childcare. And you know, there's an interesting situation in Canada, where I'm from, where one of the provinces, Quebec, in an effort to increase its fertility, you know, created a $5 a day childcare, and birth rates jumped as a result, and employment, you know, jumped among women in the population because they could work and they could still have their kids because it was affordable to do so. So that's one of the questions that I have. And then the second question is, can we flip this on its head? You're talking about China, where you're talking about what are the implications and how can you perhaps control demographic growth through employment policies. But what about parts of the world where you're trying to increase demographic growth? I come from a province in Canada, New Brunswick, where the young population is really declining, and we have a very aging population, and it's going to have significant economic implications for the province. And so, you know, the province is trying to increase immigration, and increased child birth would be a really good way of doing it, but it doesn't seem to be very successful. So how could some of what you've talked about potentially have implications for those areas that may want to see increases in fertility rates?
So child care, definitely a very important issue, and as I mentioned briefly in passing there, there's not a lot of good setups for child care in the cities when these women are migrating, and that's part of what generates this whole trend of temporary migration, leaving the children with the grandparents. The incompatibility of working full-time in a factory in the city with raising young children. Now, there could be many policies, including allowing the parents, you know, the grandparents to move with the family to cities, is one main avenue of child care in China still, the grandparents, or subsidizing more child care centers. As I briefly mentioned, that was in every work unit pretty much in the Mao era because they knew that was central. But you know, China, it's changing lots of policies, but, you know, that's an area where obviously much more could be done if what they were really worried about was fertility being way too low. There are many other things that they could do by just allowing people who want to have more children to have more children, as we are discussing. And also related to your second point, I mean, Japan might be a great example of that as well, where there are severe macroeconomic consequences, and they're not really considering allowing more immigration, all sorts of issues there. But you can look at China's own Hong Kong, which has very low fertility rates, and think about, well, maybe China has put in place a whole set of policies as well as a generational transition where when they release the policies, maybe fertility is just going to still be extremely low. Now, some of that relaxation is already allowing someone who's a only child, both the husband and the wife, if they're only themselves only children, they can have two children. But you know, any of you are from China, think for yourself, do you know many who have chosen to have two or more children? So maybe those are more permanent changes. We won't know for a while, but certainly the issue of very low, below replacement fertility is a big issue in many parts of the world, some not far from where we're talking about, Japan, Korea, and of course in Hong Kong.
So can I say a couple of things? One on child care. Karen mentioned it quickly in passing, but during the Mao era, there used to be child care, and people had lots of kids. so that clearly can make a difference. Secondly, this said about China as opposed to, say, the United States, and my guess is Canada, is being a central, you know, a country with some degree of centralized control and an authoritarian government, you can change policies more dramatically than you can in the United States. In the United States, we need to have a fairly significant approval before we get any significant social changes. In the terms of low fertility, which is clearly the big problem for the developed world, people have tried to do things about it. I mean, the most, I would say, innovative program was one in Singapore, which also has the advantage of one, a very clever government, and two, an authoritarian government, and it hasn't been very successful. They were trying to do two things. One is boost the birth rate, and the second is they were trying to boost the birth rate for well-educated women. And so they had differential subsidies. So poor women got a bigger subsidy when they had the first kid and the second kid. But if you wanted to have more kids, rich women, or not, women with college degrees got much bigger subsidies. And it's had a very modest effect, but some effect. The other thing that I think is worth talking about is changes in social mores and can you go back? I mean, when I was growing up in the United States, and I think I'm the oldest person in this room, it was common for middle-income suburban families to have three kids. And now it's common for middle-income suburban families to have one kid or two kids maybe. And a lot, you know, some of that is the fact that women are working more. But a lot of it is just that social mores change. And will that, you know, will that happen again, or have we permanently reached this new state? And, you know, I don't, so what you have to think about is the combination of social policies, and then as I respond and I decide, ooh, I think I'll have more children, that makes it more acceptable for Iris to have more children. And it's very hard to know. The one thing I do know is demographers have done terrifically in predicting how many people will be getting Social Security 10 years from now, because we can look around and see them, and they're all, you know, if you're 55 today, you'll be 65 in 10 years, and death rates go down, but don't change dramatically. And they've done terribly in predicting the number of babies that are going to be born in various countries, because, you know, I think a lot of it is social mores. It's sort of a little bit like the question, will Chinese sort of wake up to the fact that girls are in higher demand, so we better, you know, not have so much, you know, gender-selected abortion. I don't know.
Your presentation is very interesting and of particular interest to our Chinese male.
Very attractive man, by the way. I want to put that in.
I wonder, have you ever considered the impact of the samples, spouse, working, or occupation status? That relates to the previous question about child care. Of course, in China, my sense is that women will consider a lot about their spouse's occupation if they got their husband got more time, more energy to care the family, and that might be a contributing factor that encouraged their wives to get a child or more child. And I think this is more operational, much more operational variable that could be included in the survey and included in your research. I know that you have the household income as a control variable, but I think the spouse's occupation is, you know, kind of a more specified and can generate more, I think, clear policy implications. And the second question is, I'm suggesting that you might try to do a kind of a quantile regression. Of course, I was concerning about the ages, different ages of your samples. Say if they are in their 40s, 50s, they might have a kind of a preferred numbers of children or a certain number of cumulative children. But if they were in their 30s, 20s, different generation, different idea, different notions, and different decisions and different preferences. So I think quantile regression might be worth a try. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. As you alluded to in your first comment, there are some issues that come up with just sheer data and statistical issues. So we do have data on the husband's occupation and in various specifications that we've tried. We didn't show all of them here. We do include that. But as you know, it's highly correlated with household income and also with the woman's education and occupation as well, because, you know, we have a marriage market where the occupations and the socioeconomic status are correlated between the man and the woman. So, but you're absolutely right, it can play a role. Another variable we have here that I didn't mention was whether or not they have health insurance, which is also linked to often the husband's occupation or at least one of them. So definitely is important, and it's partly because of just the statistical issues of them all being highly correlated that we couldn't talk about each one individually. And quantile regression, a great idea. We haven't actually tried that yet. It's a small sample. We sort of want a larger, more recent sample, but that's something we can definitely try as well.
A humorous anecdote for those of you who are not from China. When we were in China this spring, we were in the Central Park in Chengdu. And as there are lots of wonderful things that happen there, particularly for elderly people. And one of the things that elderly or, you know, late middle-aged people do is they stand there with pictures of their children, I think disproportionately men, sort of saying, here is my son, he's a fine young man, he has this job, that job, and the other thing. Iris, wouldn't you like your daughter to meet my son? Because the men not only don't have enough time to take care of the kids, they don't even have enough time to go and meet eligible women.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned that if you have, the grandpa-grandma generation is also of great impact on the women's decision whether they should have a child or more child. Of course, we Chinese expect more kind of health care from our, parents, not from the social workers or the market.
Yes, back to the child care question. Certainly, yes.
I was wondering about just generalizing from these and these the fact that they go and they just spend like a good chunk of their week, and I think they even spend more than just the weekdays sometimes in these dormitories, these same sex dormitories. So it's just,
you can spend years.
Just limits your probability. The physical separation of men and women limits the probability of children, you know? So I was just wondering, did you look, for instance, at, like, the distance that you are traveling to work or anything? I don't know if there's any way of looking at maybe rural areas versus urban areas or something. So, like, would fertility rates be more affected in rural areas where the men and women are segregated for more of their, you know, high fertility and high productivity years than in the urban areas, for instance? I mean, I guess that there's some confound there because I guess people are more strict about, but you're controlling for the one-child policy, right? So the one-child policy is stricter in urban areas than it is in rural areas. I don't know how to think about that, but I wonder whether that could affect your results or how you think about generalizing to other parts of the world where mm-hmm. people don't have to commute in that way to dorms to work.
Right. Well, it is a huge public policy issue and a family and work issue in China. A lot of the migration, say, in rural areas will be women or men who just finished high school or maybe before they finished high school. They migrate to cities. Average length staying there is about 7 years. Women might come back to a marriage and have children, leave the children with the grandparents, and then migrate back. So it's not even just weekdays. Some areas it could be for years. It could be across provinces. This data is not the best to capture that. It doesn't have the length of your commute time. Indeed, if you're a temporary migrant, it doesn't necessarily capture that either. It's a difficult thing to capture with a large data set, but it would be fascinating to look at when we can get such data.
Would you get a sense for what the Chinese government policy is probably going to evolve to with regard to the desired birth rate? Do they want a replacement birth rate, higher, lower? And then also the disparity between males and females. So apart from what is really on the books today, but where you see kind of the trend going?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that, and people have been watching it closely, and I don't know the minds of Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang, but there was recently a merger of the Family Planning Commission with the Ministry of Health,
so they're now the one ministry. And a lot of well-known and well-regarded demographers, even in China, like Wang Feng, had thought maybe this would signal a change in policy. So far, not, but we don't really know for sure what the future range. I mean, there's consensus among demographers within China who have given lots of policy advice about many different things, Care for Girls campaign to try to address the gender imbalance and so on. There's largely a consensus among those demographers that these policies of strict birth control need to be relaxed given the change in China's population and all the macroeconomic implications. And there's clearly a policy preference to do something about the gender imbalance that's well known to be a problem. But whether it's clearly linked to these specific policies and we're going to do something about those specific policies in this local region, that's still not entirely clear. We'll see over time period going forward whether they choose to moderate those policies beyond what they're already doing, which is saying that if you're a single child, both the husband and the wife, you can have more than one child, and so on.
Can I just make one point? You mentioned earlier that this applies particularly to cadres, meaning members of the party, and the people who may care about this a lot are Communist Party officials who have to be adhered to this much more strictly than do other people. So that at least gives some spur that maybe something will happen.
I was wondering whether you were looking also in the changes in family structure. So we know that the women, they left the children with grandparents, and I was wondering whether the children is coming back home onto the rural area, whether she will be more empowered towards in the family structure.
Right, well, this research doesn't look at that directly. There are many people that have looked at that or try to look at that in more detail. And there is some evidence that I'm aware of that does show that when women are earning more and come back with more, there's evidence of more empowerment in some sense. My recent postdoctoral fellow, for example, looked at the impact of the 2001 divorce law and found that when that it had many implications, including more equal property rights, and through a various strategy looked at its impact on the sex ratio imbalance and found that it was going more towards gender equality for the second and higher births after the divorce law. So there are many policies that impact upon that and ways of trying to getting at it. This research doesn't, but it would be an interesting thing to follow up further. Well, there are many ways you could try to address that question. I mean, there are many individuals who would be heterogeneous in preferences, so we talked about that. I mean, it would be a whole different study to get at that in detail, but we do generally find that both men and women that have higher education tend to have preferences and actual fewer number of children, but in China it's a very specific context. And I might just note that it's not only China where there tends to be some preference to have both a boy and a girl. I mean, you can find that in many countries around the world. Just the idea of being able to have both a boy and a girl is often preferred.
I thought it was really interesting and a very creative instrumental variable with all the comments that we always have, but it's great. Two comments about your conclusions. One is, you know, in addition to increasing women's employment opportunities, you mentioned in passing that the gender gap in wages has increased. So that's, of course, another potential policy instrument that one could think about. Why has that happened? How could that be addressed? And what's going on? Maybe these women don't work because there's no money for them. And my second comment is, it very much reminds me of what happened in Western and Eastern Germany after the wall had come down. So it's another interesting experiment, and they found exactly the same pattern that you're finding in China now, with formerly communist Eastern Europe generally, but Eastern Germany in particular now, with the same, in that sense, maybe Morris, of the same culture, broadly speaking, that fertility rates went down, women's employment rate went down, gender gap in wages went up, everything that you've also found. And so it may be interesting to kind of compare, and there seems to be certain differences, like the rural, urban specificity, you know, the mobility and the migration seems to be very China-specific. I know nothing of that sort from Germany, but certainly the general communist, post-communist change and changes in institutions, including childcare, education, and other things as well, but they've had the very same trends that you're finding here.
They were only thinking of the timing because they are constrained to just have one. Whereas Hubei, the possibility option that they have seemed to be quite different from what you would have in Beijing. So your model must fit very well for farming population, which is being urbanized. But I wonder if it applies to some province like in a very developed place. And also, I really enjoyed your paper very much because I am from a very low fertility country.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it doesn't. I only touched briefly upon it, but the province-specific variables are all highly significant in almost every regression we ran. So there definitely are disparities, regional as well as urban rural, that you can imperfectly account for in that way. So thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.
For your questions.
You've spurred a lot of thought and connections to a lot of other parts of the world, clearly. So it's really, thank you so much. And it's also ideally really on that spot of being very academic, but also really with lots of practical implications and food for thought on both ends. So thank you very much. Please come back next week. We have Professor Lakshmi Iyer from Harvard Business School, and she's going to actually do a paper in our Women in Politics theme. She's going to talk about pathbreakers. How does women's political participation respond to electoral success? So hope you'll be back next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's really